Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today, we go on the hunt for a creature that many consider nothing more than a myth, the dragon. Of all the monsters that haunt our history, the dragon has been with us the longest. Stories can be found going back centuries, across the world. From Asia to Australia, Europe to the Americas, the dragon has had a hold on our psyche since records began. Yet even in this modern era, people still claim to encounter dragons all around the world. Joining me to look into the history of the dragon and some of the more modern encounters is our good friend, cryptozoologist Richard Freeman. We look at dragon legends from around the world, the different types of dragons there are, and some of those modern day sightings in depth. A big thank you to Richard for diving into this subject that remains as popular today as it ever has. As always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon by clicking on the link in this week's show notes for $4 a month, and our first prize draw has just begun. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and we are also on YouTube under Mysteries and Monsters. The website is, of course, mysteriesandmonsters.com. A big thank you to Dean Bestor for the artwork as always. The show was produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Dragons have continued to appear in popular culture, and, as Richard explains, they may not be simply figments of our imaginations. On this episode, we look into one of the most ingrained cultural phenomena that inhabits the world: dragons. From ancient Greece to the Americas, from China to Africa, dragons are known throughout the world. But are they simply legends? Joining me to question if dragons are really just the stuff of legend is our good friend, Richard Freeman. Richard, welcome.
Hi, nice to be back again, Paul.
How are we? How are we keeping?
Oh, pretty good. Yeah, looking forward to seeing the back of lockdown.
Yes.
Like everybody else in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, fingers crossed, the pubs are slowly opening, we can start to do things and go to shops we've never really missed, but here we are.
And yeah, long may it continue. I went to a couple of pubs for the first time in months and months the other day, and it's so bloody cold. You have to sit outside, you're shaking.
Yeah, I must admit, we went out the first Friday, we were all out. I took my thermal jacket with me just in case. I mean, we were under a heater as well, Rich, but I just wanted to cover all the bases, my friend, and luckily we managed to survive. But the week after we went out and we were just sat we were kept being put into shady areas, and it wasn't the nicest. We ended up coming home early, so yeah, not the best timing of the year to open the beer gardens, I suspect. So, dragons, Richard. Now, this is a subject that you've actually written a full book on, I believe, back in 2005, which was Dragons More Than a Myth, which is one of your first books, wasn't it?
It was my very first book, and it took about 7 years to write and research. No other book has taken me so long.
Mm.
I even started writing this before TSZ Press even existed, and I was writing it way back in the mists of time. And since its publication, I've written another book on dragons, focusing mainly on dragon lore in Britain, called Explore Dragons with Albion Press. And most recently, I wrote a book called Adventures in Cryptozoology Volume 1, which has a whole chapter on dragons as well.
Yes. So, would you say that dragons are a subject that have interested you for as long as you've been interested in cryptozoology, Richard? Or is it something that's developed as you've discovered more about the world around us?
It goes right back, before my interest in cryptozoology, right back to my childhood, before I'd ever even heard the word cryptozoology. I heard the legend of St. George and the dragon, and I thought, this is ridiculous. St. George with his lance on his horse wouldn't have stood a chance against the dragon. The dragon had just swatted him like a fly. And that's first what got me interested in dragons. And of course, St. George, in reality, was he never set foot in England. He was born in Syria, and he had a job. His main job was providing pork to the Roman legions, and they found out he was stealing the pork, and they chased him out of the country. And he became a bishop of an unorthodox Christian sect that didn't believe in Christ. And his luck waxed and waned with whether the Roman emperor at the time was a Christian or not, and he taxed and vandalized pagan temples so much that in the end he was locked up for his own safety, but a mob broke into the jail, beat the living crap out of him, and then threw his carcass into the I think it was the Red Sea they threw it into. So he never met a dragon. When Catholicism reabsorbed this weird little sect that had grown out of it, he was looked on as a martyr and became a saint. And then much later, the whole thing about the dragon was tacked on. And basically, it's a rip-off of the old Greek legend of Perseus and Andromeda, where Andromeda is staked out as a sacrifice to the sea serpent Cetus, and Perseus fights the sea serpent. He doesn't kill it with the Gorgon's head, as many people think. That's a totally wrong. He killed it with a magical sword. But this was taken and stuck onto the St. George legend. So St. George is basically like a more seedy version of, a sort of seedy 3rd century version of Del Boy.
Well, that's certainly one way to describe it.
He would have probably died of fright if he saw a dragon. The dragon itself is the great-great-grandfather of all monsters. And forget about vampires and demons and zombies and werewolves and giants. Before them all was this original uber-monster, the dragon. I've found cave paintings of a dragon 25,000 years old in France. It seems a dwarfing mammoth, this great serpentine head and neck. In China, 10,000 years ago, there's rock art of dragons. And it turns up in Sumeria and Babylon. That is worshipped by the Aztecs, feared by the Vikings and the Celts. And recently, a folklorist called Michael Wetzel from Harvard University, he used phylogenetic analysis of the dragon legends to trace them back. Now, this phylogenetics is basically, it's a system used mainly by biologists where they look at shared derivative traits to see how one organism is related to another. But Wetzel used it on legends, and one of the legends he used on was dragons, and he traced it back in time further than anybody thought. In his work, The Origin of the World's Mythologies, he dates the first dragon legends to around 40,000 years ago in sub-Saharan Africa. So they really are ancient, and they're found now in every single culture on Earth.
Mm.
All of them. Cultures that would have never ever met or exchanged information or have remarkably similar legends of these giant reptiles. And it seems that the dragon has its teeth and claws into the psyche of mankind, and it's not about to let go.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that's always interested me about dragons, Richard, is that they seem to be in every culture in the world. There is a history of stories regarding dragons from virtually every continent on the planet. And I find that remarkable that, as you say, there are other creatures like vampires and zombies and werewolves. And yet dragons seem to have just pollinated the entire psyche of the world's history for as long as we can remember.
They are the most ancient, the most widespread, and the most powerful archetype of any monster. Now, over here in Europe, there are a number of different kinds. You have the true dragon, which is the most powerful of them all, sometimes called a fire drake, and that has four legs, two leathery bat-like wings, great long tail, huge jaws and teeth, and it breathes out fire, often associated with guarding treasure. Always malevolent and destructive, and often having sinister magical powers. One thing that really drives me up the wall is how in film there's a tendency to depict dragons as only having two legs and two wings like a bird, when in actual legends this goes back as far as Babylon and Sumeria in ancient China. The dragon has four legs and two wings. The creature with the two legs and two wings is a related creature called a wyvern, which is much smaller than a dragon. It was supposed to have had a sting in its tail like a scorpion and spread plagues. It was nowhere near as powerful as the dragon and less associated with fire. And that really annoys me that this same idiotic mistake is made again and again. It started with a film called Dragon Slayer in about 1981-82, and other filmmakers have copied this, and we've seen it in everything from The Hobbit, which was probably the worst offender, because when Tolkien drew Smaug, he always drew him with four legs and two wings, to things like Harry Potter and Game of Thrones and most films you can mention. And I find it really, really, really annoying. I remember being in the cinema when Smaug was revealed in the second part of The Hobbit, and he was shown as a wyvern. I was shouting at the screen, my fury at Peter Jackson.
Well, yeah, because Tolkien was a real believer in the legend and myth of dragons, because I believe he based Smaug on the one from Beowulf, didn't he?
Yes, he was a scholar of Anglo-Saxon writing, so it was the first long Anglo-Saxon story set down on manuscript. I mean, it's all Norse, it's set in Scandinavia, but it was written down in Anglo-Saxon. And then, as well as the true dragon and the wyvern, we have the worm, which is essentially a huge serpentine creature with no limbs at all, and its power is poison rather than fire. And they were supposed to grow from small snake-like creatures into these huge things that could coil around hills and suck the milk from cows and swallow pigs and calves and things. The most famous being the Lambton worm.
Yes.
In the northeast of England. And one of the powers that the worm had is if you hacked it in two, it would rejoin together again. Then you have the basilisk, which is originally from the Middle East and North Africa. And in the original writings, it was said to be a small snake with a crown-like marking on its head. And it was believed that basilisks happened when a rooster, not a hen, a rooster, a cockerel, laid an egg, and the egg was hatched by a snake or a toad, and the basilisk would emerge, and its gaze was so deadly it would kill everything that it's laid its eyes on. It would even split rocks asunder with its terrible gaze. And the deserts of North Africa were thought to have been caused by a plague of basilisks. And then a little bit later, as the legend evolved, it was a sort of snake with a rooster-like comb on its head. The name means little king basilisk, and they were supposed to have turned up in Europe. Exeter, there was supposed to have been one in a well near a pub called the White Hart that was killed people with its venomous breath. In Poland and Austria and places like that, there are a lot of basilisk legends. There are a lot of stories about them inhabiting cellars and wells and killing people that go in there. And there's one story about a man who goes in, he's a condemned prisoner, but he'll be forgiven if he can destroy the basilisk. So he takes a mirror with him, a big mirror down into the cellar, and the basilisk sees its own deadly gaze, and it's killed by the gaze, because its gaze is as deadly to it as to anything else. And then as time went on, the basilisk, it sort of broke off into another creature called a cockatrice.
Yes.
Which looks like a rooster with a serpent's tail and has more or less the same powers as the basilisk. Oddly, it was said the only animal that it couldn't kill with its gaze was the weasel. And it's thought that maybe the legend of the basilisk started with cobras, spitting cobras that cast their venom at the eyes of their victims. And there was a confusion between the weasel and the mongoose, because the mongoose will attack and kill venomous snakes. Of course, mongooses and weasels look alike, but they aren't closely related. But these are things, how these legends start. And of course, there's a type of condition that affects hens, where it stops the production of estrogen, and they develop male-like characteristics, like crowing and growing spurs and having a larger comb. Mm. And sometimes when they get this, a condition can pass, and then they'll lay eggs again, so it'll look like a rooster is laying an egg. Mm. Maybe that's where that came from.
Yeah.
And of course, there are parasitic worms that can get into the system of a hen, and they'll go all the way through the system and be in the egg when it's laid. So if you can imagine someone, you know, 500 or 600 years ago in a kitchen somewhere cracking an egg, and this little wriggling snake-like thing is in there, they have no idea what it was. So that's possibly where the basilisk legend comes from. Moving away from Europe, in Asia, we find it's completely different. But in Asia, these things are generally looked on as godlike creatures associated with rainfall.
Mm.
And control over water, over rivers, lakes, seas, oceans, and rainfall. The Chinese dragon was very interesting in that it went through a complex staged life cycle, taking 3,000 years to complete. Interestingly, at various stages of its life cycle, it looked different. And dragon's eggs were supposed to resemble huge gems. They hatched after about 500 years, and what came out was a small, unimpressive-looking water snake. And then after another 500 years, this tiny snake would have grown to this enormous serpent, a bit like the Western worm. And then in the third phase, it grows the crocodile or dinosaur-like head and the four legs. Then in the fifth stage, it grows these branching horns. And in its final stage, it grows wings, which will carry it through the heavens. And when people say that Chinese dragons don't have wings, well, they do eventually. It just takes them a very long time to grow them. They're not born with them like the fire-breathing Western dragon.
Hmm.
And they're more god than beast, the dragons of the East. In Japan, it's different again, because the dragon is supposed to be born fully formed, hatch out fully formed, and to grow to its enormous size very, very quickly, almost immediately.
Mm.
The Japanese dragon, though it looks very like the Chinese dragon, only has three claws on each foot, whereas the Chinese dragon has four, unless it's the imperial dragon, and that has five. And the pedigree, if you see how far the pedigree goes back, Confucius, the philosopher Confucius, who lived from 551 to 479 BC,
mm-hmm.
he wrote this of dragons. He says, "I know how the birds fly and how the fishes swim and how animals run, but there is the dragon. I cannot tell how it mounts the winds through the clouds and flies through heaven. Today I have seen the dragon." And then the Roman poet Marcus Linnaeus, who lived AD 39 to 65, he says, "You too, the dragons who shine with golden brilliance, you move on high with wings, and chasing the herds, you tear apart massive bulls, constricting them in your coils. Even the elephant is not safe because of his size. You condemn every animal to death."
Mm-hmm.
Homer, not Homer Simpson, but the Greek poet Homer,
yes.
The mysterious poet who lived 800 BC,
mm.
he writes again of dragons, and he says, "An earth-born serpent, the accursed terror of the Archean grove, arises on the mead, and loosely dragging its huge bulk, now bears it forward, now leaves it behind him, a livid gleam in his eyes, the green spume of foaming poison on its fangs, and a threefold quivering tongue, with three rows of hooked teeth, and a cruel blazonry rises upon his gilded forehead. The Anician kung countrymen held him sacred to Zeus, who has the guardianship of the place and scant worship of the woodland altars. And now he glides with trailing coils about the shrines, now grinds the hapless forest oaks and crushes the huge ash trees in his embrace. Oft he lies in continuous length on the bank and across the streams, and the river, sundered by his scales, swells high. But fiercer now, when all the land is panting at the command of Dionysus, who has brought a drought, and the nymphs are hurrying to hide in the dusty beds, he twists tortuous, writhing flame upon the ground, and the fire of his parched venom fills with baleful rage. Now, these examples I've given is to show that in the early days, dragons were thought of as godlike creatures. They weren't just outsized fire-breathing lizards. They were creatures of cosmic significance. Tiamat in Babylonia was supposed to have created the gods herself. She was the original entity that gave birth to the gods and to a whole host of other monsters as well. And these ancient deities, always associated with guardianship for water, always associated with water rather than fire. The fire is somewhat of a later thing.
What's always interested me, specifically in regards to the Chinese dragon, Richard, is that you've got the 12 signs of the Chinese zodiac, and there are 11 animals we know exist, and a dragon. And the Chinese have such a rich history of belief in the reality of dragons that I think, as a culture, they're probably the one that's most associated with the dragon. Or would you say that that was something that all cultures, going back a couple of thousand years, were of a very similar mindset, Richard?
Well, all cultures have dragons in them. The Chinese are particularly associated with the dragon. Mm. But if you look at Britain, Britain alone has about 100 dragon legends in it.
Mm.
A small place like Britain. I mean, there was one American writer, I can't remember his name now, he said he called the British Isles the headquarters of dragons because it had so many dragon legends in it. So I was talking to you not so long ago, wasn't I? You didn't realise there were so many dragon legends in Yorkshire.
Exactly, yeah. I was educated and intrigued by that, Richard, especially as one actually occurred very close to where I grew up in Cawthorne Park.
Yeah, oh yes.
So yes, always an education, Richard. Thank you.
Yes. So what I was thinking of doing in this talk is taking a look at the various theories about what is behind the dragon legends, and then going on to have a look at some modern-day sightings of dragon-like creatures.
Yeah. For me, I think that's the thing that a lot of people don't comprehend when we talk about dragons, Richard, is that for a lot of people, there is a reality to this subject. It's not just myth and legend. And up until the 17th century, scholars would talk about dragons as if they were real creatures, which is something that you would very, you know, you're very hard pressed to come across like these days.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In books like Edward Topsell's A History of Four-Footed Beasts and Serpents, he includes, with all the other animals, he includes dragons of a number of different kinds of dragons, and he includes them alongside all the other known creatures. In the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, which are a series of books recording the history of ancient Britain, it tells of dragons being seen flying in the sky above Lindisfarne and other places like that. And these are not comets seen in the sky, because comets are recorded differently. They're recorded separately to the dragons. And it was said that the dragons had snouts like swine, probably meaning they had these big broad nostrils.
Yeah, because I've seen some people dismiss old stories and writings about dragons as comets, Richard, and basically saying people said that they'd seen these strange fiery things in the sky and presumed it was a dragon. But that's one of those things where I think you're using probably a more Western explanation for dragons to explain all dragons, which simply isn't the case, is it?
No. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, they list comets completely separately to dragons, so you can't use that as an explanation for dragons at all.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those, I think, that often you will get an explanation and it becomes a one-size-fits-all until you actually dig into the subject and realise that it just doesn't fit.
No, it doesn't. And there are a number of these so-called explanations, and one of them really fit. It was the year 793 that fiery dragons were seen flying in the sky, and it was seen as a portent of terrible events for the north of England. One of the other explanations was that the bones of dinosaurs and other large animals from a fossil record have been misidentified as dragons. Now, certainly dinosaur bones in China were called dragon bones. Absolutely, they were called dragon bones. They also believed that when a dragon shed its skin, it also shed its bones and grew a new skeleton. And the bones would fall from the sky and turn to stone. And they were used in Chinese medicine, ground up and drank with water for various different ailments. And there are whole treatises written in ancient China on collecting dragon bones. It was thought only men should do it. If women did it, they lost their potency. The yellow ones were more effectual than the black ones. And there's lots and lots of rules and directions for collecting dragon bones.
Mm.
But then that doesn't explain the sightings and interactions with living dragons that come throughout Chinese legends from all over the country. So it's sort of putting the cart in front of the horse, really. Well, I think that dinosaur bones are not the cause of dragon legends. They were just interpreted as being the bones of these huge creatures that people were encountering.
Mm.
So we can dispense with that. Although dinosaur bones have a part to play in the whole tapestry of dragon legends, they're not the cause of dragon legends. Mm. So we could go on to looking at meetings with gigantic reptiles. Now, I covered this before, but that was in a Patreon-only episode, if I remember, wasn't it?
It was, yes, we did. We did some giant reptiles terrifying people around the world, Richard, yes.
Now, in 1844, Charles Gould, who was an Australian biologist, wrote a really interesting book, and you can get this online now, and you can get it, still turns up in shops, in second-hand bookshops, and on Amazon fairly cheaply, a great book called Mythical Monsters. And it looked at various monsters from history, like unicorns and sea serpents and, above all, dragons. And Gould tried to work out what could be behind the dragon legends. And he came up, after, you know, a couple of chapters talking about dragon legends, his idea that the dragon legend was based on a monstrous monitor lizard, a gigantic monitor lizard with wing-like fins on its side, rather like the little dragon, a little lizard called the flying dragon in Indonesia, which glides from tree to tree with an extended rib cage that's covered in skin. And he thought that the actual dragon was just a huge monitor lizard with a similar wing-like fins on the side and a venomous bite, and it would have lived in Asia and the Middle East until a couple of thousand years ago, and that was what was behind the dragon legends. But he was closer to the truth than he probably realised, because back then, in 1844, nobody knew about Komodo dragons. Komodo dragons weren't discovered until the turn of the last century, when an aviator crash-landed on the island and had to climb up a tree to escape these gigantic lizards. There'd been rumours about these, some sort of monster reptile leaving it on this handful of Indonesian islands. But it wasn't until then that someone from the West actually saw one of these things. And the Komodo dragon grows to about 10 feet long. So it's not gigantic the way that Gould envisioned, but it has a venomous bite. It's the biggest venomous animal in the world. And it's got razor sharp teeth, and its saliva is packed with venom. When you see them, or film of them, they've usually got great strands of saliva hanging from their mouths.
They do often look rather rather strange in the fact that they always seem to be salivating, Richard.
Yeah, but that saliva's with poison, and the poison acts as an anticoagulant, so they can kill animals as big as water buffalo by biting them and just letting them bleed to death. And they have killed and eaten humans, including a German banker who wandered off the path in on the island of Komodo in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And another time, someone went jogging on Komodo. That's asking for it, isn't it? You're going jogging on Komodo.
Yes.
All they found of that guy was one of his trainers. He'd been totally devoured.
Goodness.
Now, there was a much bigger relative of the Komodo dragon that lived in the Pleistocene epoch on mainland Australia. Australia in those days was full of very bizarre giant animals. It was like, you know, God was stoned or something, because there were marsupial rhinos, Nototherium. There were giant wombats as big as rhinos or hippos, diprotodons they were called. There was Geniornis, which was an ostrich-sized flightless bird related to ducks. There were giant kangaroos 10 feet tall, and preying on them was this giant lizard, Megalania, and it's only known from fragmentary remains, but it's been estimated to have been anywhere between 7 and 9 meters long.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
If you can imagine a scaled-up Komodo dragon with a venomous bite the size of a bus, that's a pretty formidable animal. And the ancient Aborigines would have met this creature when they first arrived in Australia. And it was thought to have died out at the end of the Pleistocene, but there was part of an ilium, a hip bone, that was discovered a few years ago that looks much, much younger.
Mm.
And the one paleontologist, Ralph Molnar, postulated it could be as recent as 200 years old, this hip bone. Now, there are stories of Megalania surviving today. And perhaps the most famous one was supposed to have happened in 1979 in the Wattagan Mountains of New South Wales. And there was a guy called Frank Gordon, who was a herpetologist, and he was out looking for skinks, small lizards, water skinks. And he took his four-wheel drive Land Rover up into the mountains to look for these water skinks. And after several unfruitful hours of searching, he returned to his vehicle and he noticed what he thought was a dead tree lying on a high bank next to the Land Rover. And he couldn't recall it being there before, but he thought nothing of it. Got into the Land Rover, turned the ignition, and the log reared up on these four powerful legs and charged off into the woods, leaving him in a state of shock. And it turned out that this was supposed to have been a lizard 28 to 30 feet long in comparison with his Land Rover.
Mm.
Well, that sighting and a lot of the others are attributed to Rex Gilroy.
Mm.
And he hasn't got the best reputation, shall we say, of people in 14 research. He has been accused of just simply making stuff up.
Mm.
And a lot of the stories of Megalania surviving to the present day are attributed to him.
Mm.
But there's another guy called Gary Opitt,
yeah,
who has a much better reputation, both as a cryptozoologist and a straight zoologist, and a number of stories that he's collected he's passed on to me. In 1984, the late Peter Sleeman, who was a friend of Gary's and a neighbour of Gary's, was walking through the forest, and he was in a stand of dry eucalyptus that had been logged previously. He heard footsteps behind him, and he thought somebody was following him. So he went off a side path and hid behind some bushes to see who it was that was following him. And to his horror, he saw it wasn't a person, but a giant monitor lizard that came lumbering around the corner. It resembled a lace monitor. Sometimes they're called goannas in Australia.
Yeah.
Except for its huge size. And he said that the lace monitor's head is about 6 inches long, but this creature had his head was four times that size and was held about 3 feet from the ground. And he only observed the head and front portions of the body. The animal was flickering out its tongue, and he realised that he was being hunted because they use their tongue, similar to snakes, to pick up the trail of their prey. And luckily, it seemed that Sleeman's hiding place was good because the monster went on its way.
Mm.
He revisited the area several times, and scaling up this animal from a lace monitor, he estimated it was between 20 and 26 feet long. And another report Gary investigated was from a woman near Brunswick Heights at the mouth of the Brunswick River, and she said she saw a lizard crawl across a road on Fingal Street when she was driving. and it covered the entire width of the road, which is some 20 feet, and then it reared up and walked off into the bushes.
Mm.
Another one, a woman called Barb Holdsworth from Portland's Road near Iron Range in the Cape York Peninsula north of Queensland in 1999, and then again in 2001, saw one of these creatures. Estimated it was around 10 metres long, and it was emerged, one time it actually emerged from a lagoon. It had a humpback and a long tail and walked on four legs. It was also seen by a number of men on horseback at a place called Blackdown Cattle Station. So you can't attribute all these giant lizard stories to Rex Gilroy, so there may be something to them. If you move over to New Guinea, you get reports that are remarkably similar of giant lizards on the island of New Guinea. In the Second World War, Japanese soldiers caught glimpses of what they were called tree-climbing crocodiles in the Papuan jungle.
Mm.
In the summer of 1960, panic broke out on the island as there were rumours that people had been killed by what they said were 20-foot-long dragons, and the monsters were said to breathe fire and drink blood, and the victims were left with huge claw marks on their flesh. The scares became so bad, government authorities moved people into areas that were protected by stockades, not often a substantial reward for one of these beasts, and the reward went unclaimed and the dragons disappeared.
Mm.
And there was an Australian newspaper sent a team to investigate, and they never saw the dragons, but what they did see were the corpses of people who had been killed by them, and the witnesses said that they reared upon their hind legs and spat fire. Now, monitor lizards can rear upon their hind legs using the back tail as a lump to make like a tripod to balance on, and the flaming breast may have been the flickering tongue shooting in and out of the jaws. In 1960, Lindsay Green and Fred Ketchum, two administrative agricultural officers, found the skin and bone of one of these dragons in the village near Karuku, and today they would have been able to identify DNA analysis, but that back then it was completely unheard of.
Mm.
1969, David M. Davis, an explorer, was shown Papuan cave paintings of like a giant lizard standing upon his hind legs, and he said that his native guide reacted with fear to the pictures.
Mm.
1978, a huge lizard was filmed, but they couldn't help but determine if it was a new species or not. But then in the mid-1980s, the famed British explorer Colonel John Blashford Snell went on the trail of it, and he found out that it was actually a creature called the crocodile monitor, or the Salvadori dragon. Now, we know that these creatures grow up to 15 feet long, but they're much more slender than the Komodo dragon. They have a very long tail.
Mm.
And it's possible that this monster that the locals call the Artrellia grows much, much bigger than we give it credit for. And the colonel asked people to get a specimen, and they shot a small one that was about 7 feet long of the Artrellia, and he was able to identify it with the Salvadori dragon. Another sighting in Strachan Island District in 1961, Robert Grant and David George encountered a grey skin lizard 20 feet long. And more recently, 1999, two groups of people spotted a dinosaur-like creature near at Lake Murray, near Morocco. It was 6 metres, 20 feet long, and it could rear up on its hind legs again with this long tail. As recently as 2004 in New Britain, which is an island off the coast of New Guinea, a giant lizard over 20 feet long, able to rear up 10 feet tall, and as thick about as a 900-litre water can, was said to be haunted in a mosquito-ridden marsh just outside the provincial capital of Kapoko. And it terrorised the town of Rabaul, and it was supposed to have eaten three dogs, and the locals thought it was a dinosaur because it's rearing upon its hind legs. It gives the impression of a huge flesh-eating dinosaur, but in fact it's just a massive lizard. And soldiers went to hunt for it but didn't find it. So that's just one. And then we've got gigantic crocodiles, and we know crocodiles go to fantastic sizes. The saltwater crocodile, biggest one ever measured, was 28 feet 4 inches. Bites 4 times more powerful than a great white shark. I can take down full-grown tigers, take down sharks. They're immense. And there are plenty of reports of crocodiles over 30 feet long.
Mm.
This 28-footer just happens to be the biggest one that was actually measured. Over in Africa, you've got the Nile crocodile, the infamous Gustaf in Lake Tanganyika. He's well over 20 feet. I've seen film of him next to a hippopotamus, and he looks more like 23 to 25 feet.
Yeah.
Of course, it was sacred to the ancient Egyptians. They took down full-grown lions, leopards, bull sharks, water buffaloes, giraffes, even rare occasions, rhinos and hippos. And in the Congo, there's supposed to be a giant form of the Nile crocodile called Mahamamba, and there are reports of these creatures 40 to 50 feet long in the Congo. Back over in Asia in the 1930s on Borneo, there was a rubber tapper called James Montgomery, and the local people along this certain river talked to him about this monster they were terrified of. And he used to employ these people on his rubber tapping plant. They were terrified of a monster that lived down this river, and they thought it was the father of the devil, and they would throw silver coins in the water whenever they saw it, as to appease it. And he went looking for it, and he saw it on a sandbank. And he said it was 30 feet long with the end of its tail in the water, which would have made it about 33 feet. At that size, it would be 3.5 tons. And he knew that his gun would be no more useful than a pea shooter against it. So he decided discretion was the better part of valor. But this throwing the coins in the water recalls the old idea of dragons hoarding treasure. And that may go back as well to the ancient Egyptians and their crocodile god Sebek, because they kept sacred crocodiles in pools and decorated them as jewels and threw jewels and gold into the water and kept them as sacred beasts. So maybe that's where the spark of the idea of the dragon hoard comes from. And also the old burial tombs, when they opened up the burial tombs and found hoards in there as well. So that's where that comes from. And then, of course, you've got snakes, huge snakes. The reticulated python grows to 33 feet long. And these big constricting snakes are quite a good analogue of the worms. And there are, again, stories of snakes much bigger than anything known to science. In South America, you have the most famous of them all, the giant anaconda, growing to about 30 feet long. But the early Spanish settlers over there called it the manatoro, or bull killer, because they said some of them grow so large they could constrict a bull or a horse and swallow them whole. F.W. Up de Graaf, who was an American explorer who spent about 7 years living in the Amazon, so he saw one beneath his canoe once in this great loop underneath his canoe that was at least 50 feet long and probably considerably larger. And there are many, many, many of these accounts of huge anacondas. I mean, just last night I was doing a podcast talk on giant anacondas and other mega snakes for AFAP. So these huge snakes and early explorers' encounters with these huge snakes may have been behind or given some sort of support to the idea of the worm-type dragon. Over in Africa, in I think it was 1969, in Katanga in the Congo, there was a guy called Remy van Leyder, who was a Belgian fighter pilot who in the Second World War was decorated for his bravery. He'd become a charter pilot, and he was flying over the jungles of the Congo near Katanga. As he came over a clearing, he saw this huge snake come out of a hole, and he said it was dark green and lighter colour below. And as the plane went over, it reared up and struck at the plane. It reared up about 10 feet high. The whole snake was about 50 feet long, and its head was about 3 feet long by 2 feet wide, this great wedge-shaped head. And he managed to take a photograph of it. Quite a faint photograph, you may have seen it.
Yeah.
Of this, what looks like a very big snake. Now, some people have examined that, said that they can see termite mounds in it, and a particular termite mound which, when it reaches a certain size, gets a sort of distinct mushroom shape. And in comparison to these termite mounds, this snake is a good 50 feet long. But I've looked at that, and I can't see the termite mounds. But
infamous picture, Richard. It's one of those that always reminds me of being a young man and the first time I saw that picture, and it was terrifying to consider the fact that in the deep, dark recesses of Africa, there could be giant snakes that fancy their chances against a little plane flying above them.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be a zookeeper. I worked with reptiles, so I can tell you that a 6-foot python has heaved massive paving stones that we used to hold down the top of a vivarium, heaved them aside like they were nothing and escaped. And I went onto the roof of the reptile house, and I had to go up a ladder and catch it again. But basically, they're a tube of muscle with teeth at one end.
Yes, they are.
But the thing about these huge reptiles is they all need heat.
Yes.
They can only exist in very hot climates. So something like that couldn't exist, say, in northern China or northern Europe or central Europe even, where these things, the stories of them proliferate. Mm. So maybe we have to look at somewhere else. There was a writer who in 1979, a writer called Peter Dickinson, wrote a book called Flight of Dragons.
Mm.
And he came up with a theory about how dragons could fly, how they could breathe fire, and the whole nine yards. He postulated that dragons were the descendants of huge flesh-eating dinosaurs like Tyrannosaurus Rex, and that they flew and breathed fire by manipulation of lighter-than-air gas in the gut. And he thought they used hydrogen gas, which is, of course, very flammable. He got the idea after seeing the Hindenburg film. And he thought that they would have had a massive, extendable stomach that was like a gas bag, and the wings would have been an extended ribcage covered with skin and just used for steering, really. The whole lift was coming from the gas held in the stomach, which was made from hydrochloric acid in the animal's stomach and mixed with limestone and a calcium from the bones of the victims to make this gas, and the stomach would have been expanded for the animal to fly. When it wanted to swoop down, it would have exhaled the gas as fire, probably with a chemical catalyst, to shoot great jets of fire out of its mouth. Very original idea, but he sort of hoist by his own petard in that he says that after death, the whole system would have broken down and that the acid in the gut would have dissolved the body, so that's why there's no fossils of dragons.
Right.
So it's ultimately unprovable, but a very interesting idea. Now, thus far, we've been looking at dragons as purely a product of natural history, as flesh and blood animals, but maybe there's something a whole lot stranger. It's an idea that dragons are not flesh and blood animals in that you or I would think of it, but are product of something genuinely, for want of a better word, paranormal. And I'll talk a bit later on about modern-day sightings of dragons, but this theory that there may be dragons come from some other plane of reality or other dimension, and theoretical physicists have postulated that there's maybe as many as 11 or more dimensions. Maybe not just dragons, but a whole host of Fortean phenomena inhabit these other dimensions. I mean, we know that molecules vibrate at a certain rate, and I'm no physicist, but I wonder, is it possible if you've got two objects whose molecules vibrate at a different rate, could they inhabit the same space? See what I mean?
Yeah.
And could there be a natural phenomenon where they speed up or slow down and become visible to us in our dimension for a while?
Yeah. Yeah.
In Islam, they have creatures called jinn.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we get the word genie from, and they're supposed to be made from smokeless fire, which you could interpret as energy.
Yeah.
And usually they can't see us and we can't see them, but occasionally they slip through to our world or vice versa. And I've been told by two different Muslims that there are different types of jinn that look different. There are jinn that manifest as gigantic dragons or serpents. There are jinn that manifest as huge birds. There are jinn that manifest as huge black dogs. There are jinn that manifest as huge black cats. And there are jinn that manifest as hairy giants. Is this ringing any bells?
It all seems rather familiar, Richard.
Yes. Now, it all dovetails with a theory I had called the Global Monster Template. When I was on my very first expedition back in the year 2000 to look for this giant crested serpent called the Naga along the Mekong River, which is a whole different story. But I remember being in a statue park. I was with a film company, and they wanted some pictures of these huge serpents and the statues of these serpents and deities in this park to use in their film. So we spent a day at this statue park, and I remember seeing that there were statues of these huge crested serpents are statues of a sacred mythological lion called the Singa. That's where we get the word Singapore from. It means lion city. It's supposed to be a lion that lives in the jungle. Even though the closest lions to Thailand are in India, thousands of miles off. There was Hanuman, the Hindu monkey god, and there was the Garuda, which is a creature half man, half bird. And I thought, good Lord, you could be in Cornwall here, because they have Morgar the sea serpent, they have the owl man, and you have the mystery big cat. And then like, something went off in my head, and I thought, hang on a minute, you get variations on this all over. In every single culture, you get dragons, you get gigantic birds, you know, like the roc and the thunderbird, and you get monstrous dogs, werewolves, demonic black shucks and barges. Things like that. You get monstrous cats. You get legends of little people, fairies, goblins, and pixies, and so forth. And you get these hairy giants.
Yeah.
These huge hulking yeti, Sasquatch, trolls, yowies in Australia. And I sort of thought about it some more. I thought, hang on, these are all analogues of creatures that would have been preying on us or competing with us on the plains of East Africa a couple of million years ago, when we were 4 foot tall, little hairy people. Mm. When there are Australopithecine ancestors came down from the trees to exploit new food sources like carrion, they would have been preyed on by crocodiles and pythons, lions and leopards, African hunting dogs. They would have been in competition with other primates. There was a giant baboon called Dinopithecus, was about twice the size of the biggest baboon today. There were other types of Australopithecine apart from our own ancestors. It's as if all of these things have been passed down in our genes. We call them fossil memories. These ancient terrors bred into us to fear certain things. But why do you think black is associated with evil and villains wear black? It's because at night we can't see very well, but the predators can see wonderfully well in the dark. So black and dark is dangerous. Why do you think that in multi-story houses, not bungalows obviously, but in two-story houses, why are bedrooms always upstairs?
It's safety.
Because getting up into the trees, safety. So I thought maybe there's some trigger, and that there's some way that a gestalt human mind, sort of the collective memory of the human race that has been brought down from the time of our Australopithecine ancestors, are creating some sort of tulpas or thought forms of our ancient fears under certain circumstances. And they manifest as these things which are, for a time, physically real and can interact with the world around them. Now, for those unfamiliar with what a tulpa is, it's a Tibetan term, a thought form. It's when Tibetan monks and priests under extreme concentration are supposed to be able to create three-dimensional, physical, real-looking entities with the power of their mind. The most famous case being Dame Alexandra David Neal, a French woman who was supposed to have travelled to Tibet and become a Tibetan Lama. And created a tulpa of a monk that followed her entourage around and was thought of by everybody else as just another monk. Although in recent times, some people have said she wasn't anywhere near Tibet at the time. She was actually in Paris and she made all this up. But there are many other accounts of people creating tulpas. One of the most famous was a Polish guy called Frank Kluski, who in the 1900s to the 1920s, specialised in seances where he would manifest animals. And the sitters at these seances would see a shambling ape-like creature, a huge dog, a monstrous lion-like cat that would lick their hands with its rough tongue, and a huge bird like a nightjar, which would sit on people's head. It's almost as if he was tapping into the global monster template. He never manifested a dragon, as far as I know, but these were indoors, so he couldn't really manifest something as big as a dragon indoors. So it's almost as if he was tapping into this, the gestalt fears of mankind, and with the aid of the sitters and the power of their minds, making it real for a while. Now, I myself have experimented with thought forms, with surprising results, and that's a story for another time, the whole Great Leeds Spider experiment that I myself have over a couple of years experimenting with torpor creation. So that could be another place where dragons come from. They could be creations of our gestalt mind, or they could be completely independent entities that come through from some other dimension. And I must again remember that originally these were thought to be godlike beasts rather than just monsters. They were thought to be creatures of cosmic significance and power. And perhaps that is because they can move from one place to another. So those are just a few theories about dragons. But there are a surprising amount of modern-day dragon sighting.
People would be very surprised, Richard, to find out that even in the 20th and 21st century, we're still getting people reporting to have had encounters with what we would consider to be a dragon.
Yeah, absolutely. For example, if you saw a glowing light bobbing around in the sky at night, you might think it was a UFO. But to the Namaqua people of Namibia, the light would mean something more terrifying than a UFO was coming, a latter-day dragon, because they have something in their folklore called the flying snake of Namibia, which is said to be as large as a huge python, with horns, wings, yellow speckled with brown, and it has this glowing light that comes from a jewel in its forehead. Now, in 1942, a 16-year-old boy called Michael Esterhuis, sorry if I've mispronounced your name, Michael, was tending his sheep, and he'd heard stories from the local people about a flying snake in the area, and he dismissed them as native fantasy. And he heard something moving and looked up and saw something emerging from a cave at the top of a hill that seemed to launch an attack on him. And he said, "I heard a sound like wind blowing through a pipe, and suddenly the snake came flying through the air at me. It landed with a thud, and I threw myself out of its path. The snake skidded, throwing gravel in all directions, and shot up into the air again, passing right over a small tree and returned to the hilltop close by." He actually passed out after this, and his father and some other men went to find him, and they found him unconscious. And so all this superstition, in inverted commas, all these stories from that the native workers turn out to be based on something real. So they sent a posse out to dynamite this cave, and they hurled sticks of dynamite in it, and they heard something moving around after the explosion. But the incident instigated an investigation by no less of an authority than Marjorie Courtney Latimer, who was the ichthyologist who discovered the coelacanth. And she interviewed the boy, and he took her to the spot, and she saw these great drag marks and furrow that seemed to have been made by a huge snake. Another famous sighting, in 1978, a French farmer was tending his cattle in the Karas region of Namibia when he saw a bright white light was heading towards him. And afterwards, he heard a massive thud and one of his cow crying out in pain, and he rushed to check, and he saw a huge horned snake with wings attacking the cow. And he said to the police, "I saw what looked like, the best matching description I can give you is that it looked like a dragon. It had a bright light on its head, which was blinding me. The color of it was brown and yellow, and it had green eyes. There was a tar-like smell coming from it and smoke coming out of its nostrils." 1988, Professor Roy Mackall, better known for his Congo expeditions and his Loch Ness hunts, investigated claims from German settlers on a remote property of seeing this huge snake, and locals described a giant featherless creature with a 30-foot wingspan that glided from hill to hill. The hills were about a mile apart at dusk, and it seemed to have layers in crevices in the hills. A team discovered the remains of ostrich carcasses in accessible areas, and it was believed that the creature had preyed on them before taking its kills to the nest area. Mackall returned to the USA without having seen the animal, but shortly after, one of his team, James Koshy, who stayed on in Namibia for a while, says he saw the creature from a distance of around about 1,000 feet. He described it as a giant glider, black with white markings. On the other side of the world, you must be familiar with a wonderful researcher called Linda S. Godfrey.
Yes.
She's best known for the Bray Road, the Beast of Bray Road, and she was the first person to investigate that. She's written some wonderful books. And in her book, American Monsters, she gives perhaps the most amazing dragon sighting in the modern day. And it's from Wisconsin in 2007. And she was contacted with a young man she calls Jim, which is a pseudonym. He said that on the 7th of October 2007, at Oconto Falls in Wisconsin, that he and some friends were at a closed-down arcade. And they'd been to see a local band, and they were just hanging out afterwards. And it was cold and partly cloudy. And suddenly they saw what looked like a fireball shoot across the sky, a ball of fire that was orange and had blue flames around it. And then afterwards, they saw an enormous white dragon fly over, and they described it as having a long neck and a narrow pointed head with white scales, huge bat-like wings, four legs tucked up close against the body, and a long tail with a heart-shaped fin at the end. A typical, and it was breathing out these great balls of fire, and it swept across this area twice. And a whole bunch of youths saw it. And when he went back home and told his mother, she didn't believe him. His mother and sister obviously wouldn't believe someone saying they'd seen a dragon fly by.
Yes.
A while afterwards, both his mother and his sister saw it flying above their house and again spitting these balls of fire. His sister said, "We saw what appeared to be, and this is the only thing we could think of describing it as, a dragon. It was making gliding movements up and down, never flapping its wings. It never flapped its wings at all. It looked almost cream. Its stomach reminded me of the underside of a cow, barrel-chested. And I remember in the moon, the moon was very bright and full that night. It had a snake-shaped head and a long pointed tail. I don't care what the scientists say, it was not a pterodactyl. It had pearly pale scales, and a fireball came from its mouth. They were very beautiful and flew gracefully, and I could see they had four legs too, all tucked underneath them, like when a bird flies. Now, they use them because on this occasion it seemed to have several smaller ones following it, which may have been young. Now, if you were going to make up a story about a dragon, you would say it was green or red or something, wouldn't you? You wouldn't say it was white.
Yeah.
And it would be breathing jets of fire like they do in films. It wouldn't be spitting out a ball of fire. That seems so, so very odd.
Yeah, very much so.
Multi-witness case. Then, 2010, you know when the Icelandic volcano with the unpronounceable name went off pop, and it stopped all the, you know, the air travel for a couple of weeks? Ejafjallajökull.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Richard.
That's how it's spelled. Christ knows how you're supposed to pronounce that. It was spewing out titanic clouds of ash into the atmosphere. One guy sent an email to my colleague Lars Thomas, the Danish biologist, who does all our hair analysis. He's connected with Copenhagen University. And he said he's watching the volcano go off through binoculars, and he saw what he thought was a plane flying around in this cloud of ash until he saw it was beating its wings. And he says to Lars, "As I see it, there are only two possible explanations. Either I was imagining the whole thing, or what I saw was, in fact, a dragon. I find that hard to believe, but then again, I don't think I could imagine something like that." Another sighting, March the 18th, 2012, the southern part of Fayette County in Pennsylvania, a man walking his dog at around 11:45 at night saw an enormous animal flying above him.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At a distance of about 55 feet, and it looked like a dragon. It had a great wingspan with clawed wings, reflective scales, and this crested head, and what appeared to be light coming from inside of its mouth, an ominous orange glow. In Japan, in May of 2003, David Nardello, who was teaching English in the town of Wakashinkiko, Osaka, Japan, is cycling home late one night through a heavy rain, and a torrent had formed a pool into a nearby rice field. He saw a white animal emerge from the pool and turned to look at him, and it had its snake-like head and neck with black eyes and fangs, and the body and tail were like a lizard, and it had four legs with clawed feet, and the wings were leathery and bat-like and hairless, and it flew into the air at a height of about 100 feet, and Nardello became increasingly scared and cycled home as fast as he could, and he's convinced that the animal was dangerous, and his neighbours said they'd heard weird cries at around the same time. And occasionally people say that they found bones of these things as well. On August 8th, 1934, a 33-foot-long skeleton was found amongst the reeds in Yingkou, Liaoning province in northeast China, a 28 vertebrae and a long-horned skull. It was put on display at a local pier, and the public considered it to be the skeleton of a dragon. The local paper, Shenqing Shipao, ran several stories on it, but and the remains were kept in a school but seemed to have gone missing during World War II. 1944, hundreds of people saw a 40-foot-long black lizard lying on a sandy beach near Chengjai Weizi village, Jilin province, covered with black scales. Over in Tibet, Lake Wenbu is supposed to be the home of a green scaly dragon with formidable teeth, a long neck, and the size of a house. It's supposed to have been flipped over boats and eaten fishermen and livestock. And in the 1940s, it was said to have flipped a rowing boat and pulled both the man and the boat in the water. And it's also supposed to have, in 1980, have killed and eaten a yak owned by a local Communist Party official who had tethered the animal by the lake. Now, you might think, oh, that's a crocodile, but Lake Wenbu is up in the mountains in Tibet where it's freezing cold and there are no crocodiles. Another strange case comes from Lake Chini, east of Sahang in the Malayan Peninsula. British engineer Arthur Potter and his clerk Inch Barahudin, agent, and two labourers also saw a dragon-like creature in May of 1959, and Mr. Potter claimed that his houseboat on the lake, he was on his houseboat on the lake at about 10:30 at night when it started to rain, and then when the rain ceased, he says, this happened. And we saw the atop roof of the boat being raised, and I shouted to Barahudin to flash his torch on it. The roof was 8 feet above the floor of the boat. The torch was flashed, and we saw a gaping hole in the roof, nearly 3 feet across. We also too saw a red eye peering down to us. It was the size of a tennis ball. We couldn't see much as the torch was not very powerful and the atap blocked the view. Whatever it was, it's exactly the same colour as the atap. It then disappeared from view. We all thought it was a huge snake. We did not think any more about it till the next morning when we found the tracks of the monster had made where it left the water. Starting from the water's edge, the tracks were 18 feet wide and looked as if something slimy had gone over the ground. The tracks continued for over 4 feet, then stopped. We picked them up again more than 100 yards away. They were the same width, but stretched for nearly 200 feet. Staying in Malaya, the explorer Stuart Weverell visited Lake Chini in the 1960s and was told of the practice of human sacrifice around a great pillar of rock that rose up out of the water, and it was believed that it was used to pacify a dragon. One of his guides, Cheng Yi, told him of a great flood that had come to the town of Pekan a couple of years before. Many people had wondered if it was the dragon demanding sacrifice because the practice had been stopped, and one day a girl out washing her clothes fell from a raft and was drowned, and it was noticed that the waters immediately receded. The townsfolk believed that it had satisfied the dragon, having taken his victim, so that the belief in these things persists, particularly in Asia. One of the most famous is Lake Tianchi, known as Heaven Lake in northeast China, said to be the lair of a dragon. In 2004, there was a mass sighting of no less than 500 people. I think this is the biggest mass sighting of a cryptid ever. And they saw the creature leaping from the water and described it as serpentine in form with a horse-like head and black scales. The following year, a number of soldiers from the People's Liberation Army saw a blackish-green serpent-like creature in the lake. German traveller Engelbert Kampfer, a great name, Engelbert Kampfer, encountered a dragon worshipped in a Japanese temple whilst travelling in Japan in 1690. He tells us what he saw: a huge four-footed snake, scaly all over, with a body like a crocodile and very sharp prickles along the back, the head beyond the rest monstrous and terrible. So what he saw wasn't a crocodile. He said it was a crocodile-like. Crocodiles don't have sharp prickles over there, but what the hell that was, only God knows. And weirdly, in the Russian Far East, where it's very cold, we have these stories as well. Russian explorer Alexander Rempel was told many stories about dragon-like creatures in the taiga, the great forest that stretches across Siberia. They were known as paimers to local people and said to have catfish-like barbels on their snouts, similar to Chinese dragons, and bodies like crocodiles. One man, Anatoly Command Igu told of three hunters who had made their camp on a snow-covered mound in the twilight and lit a fire. And they sat with their backs to the mound, warming themselves on the fire, and as the fire heated up, suddenly they felt the mound at their backs heave up, and they felt the mound was a huge reptile covered in thick grey and black scales and had a long tail and four legs. Needless to say, the men fled, and they returned 3 days later to get their equipment, which they left behind in a panic, and they discovered the carcass of an animal in the area, which was probably what the creature was preying on. Another really weird story. Rempel interviewed a 71-year-old man, Vladimir Seneovich Kurtsov, and Kurtsov was a seasoned hunter in the Russian taiga. And some years before the Second World War, he stumbled on what seemed to have been a pagan ritual being carried out by taiga nomads, and he spotted a bonfire and heard singing, and he quietly snuck up and observed a semicircle of people around the fire chanting songs in a language he didn't understand. They were performing some sort of ritual, and by the setting sun, he saw them performing incomprehensible gestures with their hands and bowing down in the direction of the sunset. Then he saw some huge crawling creature come out of the forest, and it looked like a huge black snake around 10 metres long. When it reared up, he said he saw front legs on the creature as well. And the people all raised their voices in a guttural chant. At that point, he became so afraid he turned and fled. August the 18th, 1901, First Officer F. Wolf, in charge of the Chinese custom launch, Ling Si, was off Tai Wushan Island in Hong Kong when he spotted a dragon-like creature coiled upon the sea's surface. It held its head about 3 feet from the water, had a crest on its head. We hear that again and again, crests on the head, and two fins on its neck. He ordered his second officer, V. Custer, into a gig with a number of sailors and stupidly commanded them to try and kill it with a boat hook, which seems to me about like trying to knock over Nelson's column with a fly whip. In any event, the serpent bit one of the oars in two and reared up 15 feet out of the water before diving and vanishing, and it was estimated to be about 50 feet long. Perhaps the most interesting in this group of Asian sightings occurred in Along Bay in the coast of Vietnam in the dying days of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. The French gunboat, the Avalanche, encountered a dragon-like creature in these islands dotted off the coast of Tonkin. The first was in July of 1897 with a Lieutenant Lagercel who saw the creature. And he said that these were not whales that made undulatory movements similar to snakes. They were 60 to 100 feet long, had spines along their backs, and he fired at them with naval revolving guns at a distance of 600 yards, but it had no effect on them whatsoever. Again, on the 12th of February 1898, when crossing the bay, he saw the animals again and gave chase to them again and fired several shots with the gunboats at a range of 300 to 400 yards. But although the shots hit them, they seemed to have no effect whatsoever. And he saw that the creatures would blow vapour from their nostrils, a bit like a whale blows air from its blowholes. They were grey, and the spines along their backs were black. Kay was convinced that these were the creatures which were behind the legends of Chinese dragons, because they looked very like Chinese dragons. Now, a week later, mentioned this adventure to one of the admirals, Baden there, and the governor, and many of his fellow officers scoffed at it. But he was vindicated the following day. He invited all these naysayers back to the bay onto the Avalanche, and they all saw the same creatures again, exactly the same description, these huge serpentine undulating creatures with spines along their back. It was seen by all these other fellow officers and by admirals. So it's not just captains, but admirals had seen these creatures. And again, they all agreed that this was a stylized version of whatever this animal was behind the Chinese dragon.
Yeah.
Like, I could go on all night with sightings of both marine dragons, serpentine marine dragons, and winged fire-breathing dragons, because there are many more sightings right up to the present day all over the world. But particularly with the flying ones, these huge creatures the size of planes, if they were here all the time, they'd be turning up on radar.
Mm.
More people would see them. They would be tearing fighter jets out of the sky like they were toys. We would know about them. So it seems that whatever they are, particularly these flying ones, the marine ones, yes, they could be unknown animals living in the depths of the sea, but the flying ones, the flying traditional fire-breathing flying dragon, it couldn't live here all the time as a flesh-and-blood animal because we'd know about it. They'd be snatching people, swooping down and snatching people up. And they are either something paranormal or they're something that comes through dimensions.
Yeah, or it could be a combination of things, Richard. You know, not necessarily, because there are several different types of dragons, as we've mentioned during this conversation. Yeah. They're not all the same type of creature. So whatever is causing people to see the traditional idea of what we would consider a dragon of, you know, a fire-breathing, flying creature of enormous size may not necessarily be the same ones that we're seeing come out of lakes or living in forests. So it might be a combination of things.
Have you heard of a guy called Mike Hallowell?
Yes.
A TMO researcher called Mike Hallowell. He's more or less retired now for ill health. He wrote a great book called InvisiKids on childhood imaginary friends, the first study of its type ever done. Absolutely groundbreaking book. He was investigating the history of a pub called Marsden Grotto up on the coast near Newcastle, and it's actually built into a cliff. This pub, you have to get a lift down to get to it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever been. But they've got part of the old Lambton Castle there, and they've got a pillar with a Lambton worm carved on it.
Mm.
Now, doing research into this, and he uncovered this story of a sea dragon called a Shoni, and it goes back to the time when the area was under the Dane law. The Vikings went in fear of this sea dragon called the Shoni, and they would draw lots, whoever got the short straw or whatever was trussed up, had their throat slit and thrown overboard so the creature would devour the body rather than attacking a ship, or so the story goes. And this went on after the time of the Vikings with Scandinavian sailors, and it became a sort of worship, a sort of cult. And it was said that bodies would turn up, arms tied behind their backs, throats slit, sometimes half eaten, and they would wash up as far north as Lindisfarne and all along that coast, and particularly around Marsden Grotto. And the pub, it started out a couple of hundred years ago. A guy called Blaster Jack blew the cave into the cliff face with dynamite, black powder, because he was a quarryman, and opened up a tea room there and became very successful. And then it became a pub, and subsequent owners have carried it on ever since. But the pub's beer cellar was supposed to have been used as an impromptu morgue when these bodies washed up. According to Mike's research, the last body washed up in 1928. If that's true, there was a dragon worship cult making human sacrifices in the north of England well into the 20th century. And Mike says he's tried to verify all this with police records. And one lot of police say, oh, the boundaries have changed. Our records don't go back that far. You've got to talk to this other lot of police. And they say, well, no, they're wrong. You've got to talk to them. They've got the records. And nobody fesses up to having the records going back to the 1920s.
Yeah.
And apparently he had a phone call one time just telling him to drop it, saying, don't, if you know what's good for you, don't look any further into it. Which makes me wonder if there's a vestige of the cult still around. It sounds like a plot to a horror movie.
It does indeed. It sounds like something Dennis Wheatley would cover.
That's what happened. He said he saw the creature himself once. He was driving with his family along the road near the cliffs, and he saw this great creature hump up out of the water, not brown in colour, bigger than a car. He said it had a long neck in front of it and a tail at the back. It didn't raise them above the water, but he could see them under the water. He said it wasn't a whale, it wasn't a shark. And lots of other people were stopping their cars and looking at this thing, whatever it was, until it went under again.
Mm.
One of the strangest stories I ever heard.
Very true. That is weird.
When people say there's no such thing as dragons, they're wrong. There are such things as dragons.
You've just got to know where to look for them, Richard. Fantastic. Well, that's been thoroughly enthralling, Richard. And I think, like I said at the beginning, for a lot of people, I think unless you really dig into this subject, most people would just put dragons into myth and legend alongside things like unicorns or cockatrices and manticores and things like that. But when you start to really dig into history, and especially in the Far East and Russia, you see that there are notable modern sightings that are well recorded and well witnessed.
Yes, absolutely. And those other things you mentioned all have may have a basis in fact. The manticore seems to have been a garbled report of the Bengal tiger. Mm. The unicorn may have been a antelope called Procanthus cerus, which had two horns growing from the front of its forehead that in life would have been covered in one sheath, giving it one horn, in effect. And that lived in Europe to about a million years ago, but it may have been pockets survived into historic times. And we know that the horns of animals like goats can be manipulated. They have horn buds in their skin. They're not born with horns. They have horn buds in their skin that send down chemical messages in the skull for the bones to grow in a certain way. And when they're kids, they can be quite painlessly manipulated. So these horn buds can be drawn together in the front of the forehead. So the goat grows one great horn, great long horn out of the front of its head, rather than two curving horns at the back. This was rediscovered by an American scientist called Dr. Henry Dove in the 30s, and he found that some African tribes do this. This one goat with a great long horn, this unicorn creature, defends the herd from predators because it's got this lance-like weapon. So, remarkable. In a way, unicorns are real as well.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Oh, well, it just is one of those subjects that I think the more you look into it, the more things you uncover, Richard, and the possibilities are endless when you really begin to dig into them, as you say. And I know we've touched on giant reptiles from around the world as well, but once again, like dinosaur bones, they're not one of those things that can be used as a one-size-fits-all explanation for all of these people's sightings, are they?
Lars Thomas, we mentioned him earlier, great friend of the CSZ, Danish guy, does a lot of our work with samples. He was looking into very old Danish legends of trolls, and one of the early Danish kings said he loved to hunt trolls because they were so voracious when they were cornered, and he described them as being larger and stronger than humans, massively muscular, covered in hair, thick brow ridge, flat nose. They didn't use fire. They could pick up and hurl massive rocks that no man could move, and the females had long drooping breasts. And these descriptions matched up exactly with the Almasti, the wild man of the Caucasus Mountains, that the Russians took so seriously and had commissioned to look for it. And who's to say that, you know, in past times, these things weren't more widespread? I mean, you still get odd reports from Finland and the north of Sweden of trolls that sound exactly like Almastis. And in 1988, I think it was, in the Kolar Peninsula, which is a few miles into Russia from Scandinavia, there was a multi-witness sighting of dozens of kids and an adult park ranger that saw one of these things. And it terrorised the area for hurling rocks at these youths and banging on the door of the shack they built in the forest. And they tried to get the adults convinced that there was this thing around. No one would listen to them. And eventually they sent a park warden down who thought they'd seen a bear or something. And then, lo and behold, he saw the bloody thing as well. So that's probably where the legends of trolls come from. These relic hominins, when there were greater forests in Europe, trolls would have been more widespread. So dragons, unicorns, trolls, they all have a background in something. There's a theory that the idea of the griffin came from Protoceratops skeletons. Because we associate griffins with Greece, but they had trade routes with Mongolia, and they would say that there was a creature called a griffin that nested in the desert. It made nests out of gold. It was a four-footed beast with a beak, and it lived in the desert. Where they found fossils of Protoceratops, which was a small ceratopsian dinosaur size of sheep, which had a beak like a parrot and a frilled head and a foreleg, they found nests of their eggs as well, and in strata that's very rich in gold. So one theory is that the griffin legend may have come from them.
It's amazing what you uncover when you dig into these historical reports and legends, Richard. There is usually a kernel of truth in a lot of them.
Mm.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Richard, as always, it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you on any subject, because you'll always educate and inform us on a wide variety of topics. So what's next for you, and what's on your agenda, my friend? What does 2021 hopefully hold for you?
Well, hopefully later in the year, over the summer, I'm going to go back to Mongolia to hunt the death worm in the Gobi Desert. It's just a burrowing creature which is almost certainly some sort of reptile rather than a true worm. Nomads are terrified of it, and I was over there, 2005. Most amazing place I've ever been, Mongolia. Totally alien, weird-looking place. Wonderful people. And I met 24 witnesses all describing this sort of salami-like creature, like a grass excluder that they'd seen crawling around in the Gobi Desert, that they were absolutely terrified of. So hopefully I'll go back to look for that. I think it's a worm lizard, or possibly some unknown form of sand boa. That's one thing. Yeah, I've also got a couple of possible television projects on the go, but you know what they're like. You know, most of the time they don't materialise. Sometimes they do. So hopefully I may be involved with a series, a couple of TV series. We'll see how it pans out. There's a lady I know who said she wanted to finance an expedition. So depending on how much she wants to finance us for, it will depend on how far we go. I mean, I'd like to do the Siberian lakes, the several lakes, Lake Chany, Lake Varota and Lake Loanika, where unknown creatures have been seen. Lake Chany in particular, about 19 people have been supposedly been killed by something in the lake. But it's serpentine, 30 feet long, and rams boats and grabs people and pulls them underwater. This is in southern Siberia, and the locals from the surrounding fishing villages say we want a government investigation, and none has been forthcoming. Once again, sounds like a plot of a horror movie. I'd like to go over there, do some baiting, and go with underwater cameras, see what we can find. Lake Loanika, the nomads, there's nobody lives near there, but nomads who fish the area sometimes. So there's a thing that overturn rafts and kills people and drags them under. And deer that have been chased by dogs into the lake get grabbed by this huge, what they call the lake devil, and pulled underneath. And no one's gone to investigate. No one's done a documentary on these, so I'd love to do that. And I'd love to go after the Tasmanian wolf again.
Yeah.
That's another one I think is out there. I've been over there several times, and I think we've narrowed down a good place to look, and I think it's still around there. So there's all of these projects, and many, many more, the giant anaconda, you name it. There's so much to do and so little funding.
Yeah, yeah. Any further books in the pipeline?
Yes, I've got the second volume of Adventures in Cryptozoology due out at the end of the year, and I'm going to be starting writing a new book that's got the working title of The Highest Strangeness, which is about very, very strange sightings of monsters, ghosts and UFOs, the high strangeness cases that just make my mind boggle.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to everything you got coming up, Richard. Where can everybody keep up to date with yourself and the Centre for 14 Zoology?
Check out the Centre for 14 Zoology on www.cfz.org.uk. You can email me on richard@cfz.org.uk. If you want to look up any of my books, the latest one is called Adventures in Cryptozoology Volume 1, available via Amazon, and you can order it from any good bookshop, and probably most crap bookshops as well.
Brilliant. Thank you as always, Richard. A real pleasure to speak to you. Glad to have a real chance to dive into a couple of interesting subjects with you. So thank you as always for your time, and you take care.
Cheers, Paul.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.